not going to turn into a pacifist and a logical statesman who cares about the well-being of people in the world. I mean, he's just never done that. And he's always been intimate with the defense industry. He has long-standing ties with the defense industry.
With the Biden administration not showing any practical and real interest in returning to the deal, questions arise as whether he will follow in his predecessor's track and maintain his anti-Iran pressure campaign, or will it put an end to its malign policy against Tehran, as Iran foreign minister put it. Iran, on the other hand, says the window of opportunity is closing very fast.
The steadfastness of Yemen and the resistance of Palestinians is the slogan of a press conference held by the Yemen-Palestine Organization. Participants discuss Yemeni-Palestinian relations and their common vision, which is resistance against the Zionist projects in the region.
This event is a Yemeni-Palestinian initiative for political awakening and for the unity of both nations to achieve a common goal of defeating the Israeli regime's plans in the region and liberation of Palestine. Israel is our common enemy and the enemy of Muslim nations.
The participants affirm that Yemen and Palestine have strong ties that transcend geographical borders, as Yemen has become an important part of the axis of resistance. The Yemen-Palestine Organization also revealed its humanitarian plan for 2021, which will contribute to alleviating the suffering of Yemenis due to the continuing war and the blockade imposed by the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition.
Yemenis believe that the U.S., as the main supporter of Israel, is also responsible for the sufferings of Palestinians and Yemenis. They say resistance is the only way to achieve victory and liberation. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
Almost 3 months have passed since the beginning of the intra-Afghan talks in Qatari capital Doha. The negotiating team of the Afghan government accuses the Taliban of foot dragging, but the militant group rejects such allegation.
The negotiating team of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan is fully ready for talks, but the Taliban side has ignored to attend the meetings over the past 10 days under the pretext of being busy with their own meetings.
In the meantime, this top army official, who usually spends much of his time in front lines, also accuses the Taliban of expanding their attacks amid condemnations by the Afghan people and international bodies like the United Nations. That is why officials here warn that Afghan troops may intensify their attacks on the Taliban if they continue targeting civilians.
Our message to the Taliban is to either grab the current opportunity to bring peace or stop targeting civilians. Otherwise, we will pound their positions across the country and we will kill them one by one.
Despite all ifs and buts regarding the Afghan peace process, what war-weary Afghans want is lasting peace and an opportunity to forget about war, bloodshed and misery they have been suffering for over the last four decades.
We are tired of war. We have one wish, that is to see calm and security in our country. We don't care about either the government or the Taliban, but we want an immediate silence of guns here.
So far, many regional and international players, mainly the US, have declared their full readiness to support any move toward bringing peace to the country.
This comes as many here believe the Afghan peace process has now turned into a good pretext for some local and international players. This is because such a matter allows them to further interfere in Afghanistan's affairs and follow their own interests in this wounded land. Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
The UK government is mulling over plans to put some travelers coming to England in so-called quarantine hotels amid concerns about new variants of the virus.
As we vaccinate more people, it becomes more and more important that we protect against any new variants coming in. Once you have that protection and you don't have new variants in the country, you should protect against them.
Despite the high death toll, case numbers in the UK are slowly falling, thanks to the lockdown. But the government is facing mounting pressure over when the restrictions, among them school closures, will be eased. As for the rest of Europe, well, they're worried about an outbreak of the so-called British variant within their borders.
Different European countries have different measures in place, lockdowns, curfews, but with their healthcare systems under immense pressure, they may have to enforce even stricter measures soon.
But the restrictions of freedoms already in place are testing people's patience. In the Netherlands, at least 150 people arrested Monday during unrest and looting in towns and cities across the country over an 8 p.m. curfew.
Het heeft ook niks te maken wat we zagen met strijden voor de vrijheid. We nemen al deze maatregelen.
What we saw has nothing to do with fighting for freedom. We didn't take all these measures for fun. We did so because we are fighting against the virus, and it's the virus which is actually robbing our freedom.
While the UK heads towards its mid-February target of 15 million vaccinations, across the EU, growing frustration with the pace of immunization. Last week, AstraZeneca told the EU it was falling behind on its supply target because of production problems. The EU Commission, in charge of approving and procuring the jabs, isn't happy.
This new schedule is not acceptable to the European Union. The European Union has pre-financed the development of the vaccine and its production and wants to see the return.
The delays will make it harder for the EU to meet its plan to vaccinate 70% of its adult population by late summer, leading to a deepening of the crisis across the bloc. The UK and European Union have survived Brexit and the financial lockdown of 2008, but it remains to be seen if they will survive COVID-19. Saeed Pariza, London.
Iranian Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif made a stop in Moscow for talks with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov on mutual and international issues. In a joint press conference, Zarif said Iran will take proper action whenever the United States lifts the sanctions to pave the way for its return to the 2015 nuclear deal.
What we have heard from the United States administration so far has mostly been in the form of words and announcements of its position. However, it is actions that we respond to.
For his part, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Moscow and Tehran share the same position on how to preserve the historic deal, adding that it was up to the United States to take the first steps by removing the sanctions.
Both we and Iran are deeply interested in a full return of signatory states to fulfilling their obligations under the accord.
The top Iranian diplomat said Trump's departure brought along special circumstances that required Tehran and Moscow to coordinate their positions in this regard.
Our focus today was on the Caucasus and the regional efforts for bringing peace and stability in the Caucasus, because I am right now engaged in a regional trip to countries in the Caucasus, plus Russia and Turkey. We also had a major discussion about global situation and how we can revive the nuclear deal.
With the election of Joseph Biden, hopes for a more balanced approach from Washington and a return to the nuclear deal have been revived.
If this happens, and we hope that we'll be able to achieve such a result, then of course the relations between Iran and the Russian Federation will benefit, since they will be removed from illegitimate, illegal unilateral sanctions, both from the United States and from a number of other countries.
Zarif arrived in Moscow after paying a visit to Azerbaijan, where he sat down with Azeri President Ilham Aliyev.
Iran and Russia said they are determined to expand mutual ties and continue cooperation in regional stability and international security. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Italy's Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte tendered his resignation, throwing Italy into a government crisis in the midst of a pandemic that has devastated the country. More than 85,000 lives have been lost to coronavirus as Italy's economy is falling deeper into chaos. After surviving two confidence votes last week, Conte has reportedly decided to quit because his executive risked being defeated in a vote over a contested report on the justice system in the Senate, where he no longer has an absolute majority.
President of the Republic Sergio Mattarella received this morning the President of the Council of Ministers, Giuseppe Conte, who handed in the resignation of the government that he presides. The President of the Republic has decided to invite the government to remain in charge to handle the current affairs.
The government was plunged into crisis after former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi pulled his junior partner Italia Viva out of the ruling coalition on January 13. Renzi had withdrawn his support over issues including differences on the COVID-19 recovery plan and the handling of the coronavirus outbreak. Conte is now expected to seek a third mandate from the President of the Republic Sergio Mattarella to form a new executive with a broader coalition. Should he fail to do so, Mattarella may decide to bring in a new prime minister or call for snap elections.
La risposta è molto semplice.
I'm going to make this very simple. This political crisis will result in more interest to be paid by Rome on its public debt due to an increase of the spread between Italy and Germany's 10-year yields. Whoever becomes prime minister next will have to implement tough reforms, including slashing health and social spending, in order to access the resources allocated in the EU's recovery fund.
On Wednesday, Italy's head of state, Mattarella, is slated to start a round of formal consultations with party leaders and other institutional figures to see whether a new coalition can be formed.
It isn't certain where this political crisis will lead. What is certain is that not even the world's worst pandemic in a century has persuaded the Italian politicians to remain united to face an unprecedented health crisis together. After the collapse of 66 governments in just 75 years of democracy, the country's future is now in the hands of President Mattarella. Max Civili, Rome.
Streets were deserted, shops were closed, and businesses were abandoned in Indian-controlled Kashmir as India celebrated its 72nd Republic Day.
What is there for the people of Kashmir to celebrate? Our special status was stripped, and so were our rights. The promises that were made were just a show-off. Our jobs, our land, and our opportunities are on sale. So what should I celebrate?
Amid suspended internet services and heightened security arrangements, authorities have held a symbolic Republic Day parade in a highly secured sports stadium in the heart of Srinagar. Indian-controlled Kashmir came under India's absolute control after New Delhi stripped Kashmir of its special status in August 2019. Following the move, pro-freedom groups in the disputed region were detained so that any dissent against India's decision would be prevented.
The democratic values for which the India is advocating and India is calling in the world that it is the biggest democracy, they are not following it actually on ground. Democracy gives the right of dissent.
Although New Delhi says the revocation of Article 370 was to integrate Jammu and Kashmir into the rest of India for easier development and equal opportunity for the citizens, analysts say the reality on the ground is quite the opposite.
After revocation of Article 370, which was one of the articles of the Constitution of India, the government's attitude has been more aggressive and arrogant, not people-friendly. There is no democracy on ground. The democratic setup has been closed down and an authoritative setup has been put in, which is working with a dictatorial attitude, and the people are suffering.
By staying indoors on India's Republic Day, people of Kashmir have once again displayed their level of alienation. Analysts say India needs to take necessary steps and fulfill its promises in order to win their hearts. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate. Thank you.
The Debate.
The European Union and British-based pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca have become embroiled in a fierce row over the supply of coronavirus vaccines. The European Commission says that the Anglo-Swedish firm is not honoring its contract to provide a specific number of shots. AstraZeneca has said it will not be able to deliver as many vaccines to the EU as initially hoped because of a production glitch, a claim disputed by the EU. The company announced the initial deliveries would be approximately 31 million doses, far less than the anticipated 80 million. To make things even more complicated, the EU confirmed new bans on certain vaccine exports from the continent to cover the supply shortages. Blocking the shipment of vaccines made within Europe will most likely cause a broader disruption of vaccine supplies, not just for the UK, but for numerous countries around the world.
The first coronavirus case was reported some 1 year ago in Europe. No one at the time would have imagined the massive scale of death and devastation it would wreak on the continent and around the globe. Nearly 30 million cases and 700,000 deaths have been registered in Europe alone since the beginning of the coronavirus outbreak. The actual numbers, however, are set to be much higher given the fact that many infection cases have gone unnoticed. Just days ago, the UK became the first European country to cross the grim milestone of 100,000 deaths. This is while economic powerhouse Germany continues to report daily deaths of around 1,000. Less populated countries have not been immune either. Portugal, with a population of 10 million, currently has the world's highest per capita 7-day averages of both new cases and deaths. COVID-19 and problems surrounding the disease have been compounded by the spread of more infectious and deadlier strains of the virus. The continent has been struggling to contain the pandemic despite imposing lockdowns and strict curbs, including border closures. The World Health Organization says it's too early to ease the restrictions. The UN Health Agency's European branch says transmission rates across Europe are still very high, impacting health systems and straining services. However, the lockdowns in several cases met with opposition and dissatisfaction among the public, sparking protests across the continent. Ironically, even the development of vaccines has failed to alleviate concerns. In fact, frustration is growing in the European Union after a second coronavirus vaccine manufacturer warned of supply issues to the bloc. After a cut in deliveries of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine slowed some nations' inoculation programs, AstraZeneca dealt a fresh blow by saying the number of initial doses available would be lower than expected due to production problems. The EU Health Commissioner has expressed, quote, deep dissatisfaction as millions of lives have been put at risk.
Points in all of this all along was the issue of transparency, and we had EU lawmakers and so on accusing the European Commission of showing a lack of transparency in terms of its dealings with the pharmaceutical companies. And now we have a situation where the European Commission is accusing the pharmaceutical companies of showing a lack of transparency.
COVID-19 has relentlessly battered Europe for nearly a year. Lives have been lost and livelihoods have been destroyed. But the pandemic has also had other impacts, exposing Europe's frailties, not only in its poor preparations and medical responses, but in its leadership dysfunctionality and disunity.
Joining us on this edition of The Debate, we have author and broadcaster Jonathan Fryer. Joining us from London also, we have senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, Mr. Ian Williams, who is joining us from New York. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Fryer in London. AstraZeneca, they're blaming a production fault for this delay. What do you think is really going on in this supply row?
Well, I think we should believe what AstraZeneca is saying is that unfortunately they've not been able to produce as much of the vaccine as many countries wanted. We should note that the European Union only approved the AstraZeneca vaccine today, whereas Britain did that some weeks ago. And, of course, Britain got in much earlier with its orders than the European Union, so received quite a good amount of vaccines from AstraZeneca and also of the Pfizer-BioNTech, which is mainly made in Belgium, which is why Britain has managed to vaccinate, at least with the first dose, about 8 million people already, which is way ahead of all the other EU 27 member states. So there's quite a lot of frustration on the European continent that actually they've been caught napping on this, that they are way behind what they would have hoped, and certainly way behind the British, although of course Britain does have the worst cases, the number of deaths of any country in Europe.
Mr. Williams, in New York, what do you think about the issue? Our guest in London believes that this is probably just a glitch. There are contrary beliefs to that as well. Is the British-based AstraZeneca misleading the European Union, in your opinion?
Well, it's not misleading. It might have been rosily optimistic in the contracts it signed. And there are big dilemmas here. I mean, Britain is no longer in the European Union. But even if it were, the British government would have a hard time saying, oh, we're making these vaccines here, but the company has a contract with the European Union. So they've got to go to the European Union and drive past dying people in Britain. It's a political dilemma that's not an easily reconcilable one. And we saw that with Donald Trump when he tried to sequestrate supplies of vaccines made in Europe and other places for America. You know, the politicians will want to look after their own voters first. Not necessarily their own people, but their own voters, definitely. You know, in many ways, I think it's not often I boost pharmaceutical companies, but it is worth realizing that this production of a vaccine within a year of the serious onset of the epidemic is pretty much a landmark in modern medicine. Most vaccines take years, decades to produce. The fact that within a year they've got three or four workable vaccines going, I had my first shot here in New York a week ago, and I'm hoping to have the other one next week. But it's a remarkable achievement in its way. Where it falls down is in the delivery, and you know, there you have to compare Europe, for example, which actually has a sort of a more rational health system, even the separate countries do, compared with the US, where it tends to be chaotic, and there's apart from, you know, it depends on the states, and some states have a rational distribution method, and others you've seen, you know, occasions where the vaccines go missing or go to the wrong people, or they can't get to the people who really need them, because there's no machinery for mass inoculation. Even in Britain, it's not the same machinery there was a few years ago when the National Health Service had massive inoculation campaigns for TB and other ailments. So that's somewhat fallen by. But, you know, we have to give credit where it's due to those companies that have produced the vaccine and the universities that are involved as well, of course, because there's a lot of government money involved in here. Well, no, the companies will take the credit if it wins, but the fact that they were promised their investment back by lots of governments will tend to get overlooked.
Sure.
And this is very much a public-private partnership.
Mr. Fryer, let's address the elephant in the room that was also mentioned by Mr. Williams in New York. Is Brexit playing a role in all of this?
I don't think Brexit is directly playing a role, but indirectly it is. There is unfortunately a very sour relationship between the EU 27 and Britain at the moment, not because of Brexit, but because of what has happened since Brexit, in particular the way that basically the British government has been accusing the EU of not handling the post-Brexit situation properly, and in particular calling in what they see as vaccine nationalism or COVID nationalism, which is where individual European countries are at each other's throats because of the COVID situation. And in particular, there is the problem about Northern Ireland, because Northern Ireland, which is a province of the United Kingdom, nonetheless has remained within the single market of the European Union in order to be able to trade freely with the Republic of Ireland, the most of the island of Ireland. But there is a huge row today where the First Minister of the Northern Ireland administration, who was very much pro-Brexit, has really said that the EU is acting like a bully by threatening to cut off supplies of COVID vaccines to Northern Ireland, whereas according to the EU plans for the single market, it ought not to do that. But I think we also have to bear in mind an important fact, that health matters are what's called national competence. In other words, this is the responsibility of national governments, not of the EU as such. And this is really the first time that the European Union has tried, despite that fact, to introduce a Europe-wide vaccine policy to get vaccines to everyone. But it hasn't properly worked, and individual states, we heard earlier how Hungary has put in orders for China and Russia, and other countries have put their orders wherever they feel vaccines will come. But it is rather a chaotic mess at the moment, all against the backdrop of a real crisis in the health situation, an understandable worry about people right across Europe about when and if they will actually get their vaccine.
Ian Williams, so let's basically look at it this from this vantage point. If there's a market there right now and the demand is there, and the European countries, as you also mentioned, have invested billions in the vaccine development, despite the strong demand, why is there a lack of doses? Do you think that vaccines produced within the EU might be going to higher bidders outside of the bloc?
Well, they might well do under normal, but I don't think so. I think what we're looking at is, there are contracts to be fulfilled. The European Union has altruistically entered into agreements with other countries across the world to supply vaccines under the COVAX agreement. There are commitments here, and it's, some of them are quite altruistic. But also, it's in the nature of the way things are now that you have highly centralized production, and all it takes is a glitch in one factory, one line to go, and vaccine production is out for the whole continent. So the centralization of production might lead to greater efficiency, might lead to efficiencies of scale on one side, but it also diminishes the resilience of the whole production process. So one glitch in one production line can stop the whole continental supply, whereas at one time it would have been just a regional problem.
Mr. Farr, what about the overall policies of European countries in dealing with the COVID-19 outbreak? Despite the restrictions and the lockdowns, cases are still on the rise. Unfortunately, fatalities are still increasing. The economy has suffered immensely. What went wrong in the equation? The lockdowns, as we know, saw a lot of protests across Europe. The recent ones in Netherlands also turned violent.
That's true. Of course, I think we need to recognize that the anti-lockdown groups, protesters, are a minority and, frankly, acting against the interests of the majority of the people who understand perfectly well why there have to be lockdowns, why there have to be restrictions of various kinds. But Europe has really suffered unfairly in many ways from the fact that there is freedom of movement, so not in the normal times people can circulate around Europe perfectly freely, and indeed Europeans travel all over the world. Earlier there was mention made of Portugal and the particularly sad cases that we're seeing now in Portugal, and that's largely because it's a bridge really to Brazil and other parts of South America, and the new variant, the Brazilian variant, has come in to Europe via Portugal and is now seen in several member states of the European Union and as well as here in Britain. So although border restrictions are being brought in, indeed Britain has brought in travel restrictions against quite a number of countries including the UAE as the latest, being added to the list. That, in a sense, is shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted, because the infections have spread so fast and so far in Europe, because basically Europeans move around a great deal and they mix with people from all over the world.
Mr. Williams, I saw you nodding there. Would you like to add anything to that?
Well, I was just thinking back. I was looking at the list of things today, and it was about a year ago that the British government, just being, you know, echoing Trump, was being somewhat dismissive of it, and they allowed 3,000 football fans to fly from Spain to Liverpool, when Spain, Madrid was at the height of an epidemic. I mean, there's been a complete lack of common sense precautions by the British government on many ways, and it's one of the things that's led to the scepticism that we're just talking about. I mean, you can understand people being sceptical when they're told, first of all, the masks are necessary, then they're not necessary, and then you begin to suspect that the real reason they want people not to wear masks is because they're short of them, and they want to reserve them for particular occupations like the hospitals. So, you know, there's been a lack of transparency by governments, not just in Europe, but all over the world. It's, you know, in some parts of the world, they've locked up journalists for reporting about it. Egypt was deporting a Guardian journalist for reporting accurately on the casualties. So you can understand that there's a lot of skepticism. I mean, it's almost unpardonable, the cranks, the anti-vaxxers and the anti-lockdowners who are gathering in large infectious numbers on the streets of cities across Europe to protest measures taken to ensure their health. But you can see why they would be skeptical. Governments have bred that skepticism. Right across the world, governments have given people very good reason to doubt them. And there's also that ever-present suspicion that no government will leave a crisis like this untended to, in terms of restricting people's liberties, keeping an eye on people, scrutinizing them. So, you know, travel restrictions, wow, great. You know, it's not even national borders. Remember, people are being arrested for driving from one city to another inside Britain and inside Europe. People are being arrested for driving on the hills. And the point is, of course, this is, of its necessity, is going to be capricious. The police will be arresting people who they don't like. And we know who the police tend not to like in societies like Britain and America. They tend not to like minorities, and they suspect them of spreading disease more than anyone else. So, you know, the statistics come out. These strain society in a big way. It's not just the European Union where the fracture lines are showing. It's inside countries as well.
Sure.
And governments have encouraged this. Governments have done it because their behavior has led to understandable suspicion on the part of the public.
Jonathan Fryer, touching on a point that was just mentioned by our guest in New York, fraction lines are just beginning to emerge. Speaking of Hungary has become the first EU member to approve the Chinese-made Sinopharm vaccine. It means that Hungary continues to diverge from the EU, as last week Budapest approved Russia's Sputnik V vaccine. So essentially, this shortfall is pushing the bloc to a crisis point where, despite all the money invested in European countries, now EU countries are turning elsewhere to get what they need.
Yes, of course, that is true. And we have to bear in mind the fact that the EU paid up front hundreds of millions of euros in order to get doses of the vaccines, including the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine, which is why there is the current row at the moment. They've said, we paid for it, we've signed a contract, where is the vaccine? It should be here by now, and it isn't. As you was mentioned in your introduction, basically there's a shortfall of about 50 million doses out of 80 million, which is a serious shortfall. But I'd like to echo Ian's comments about the pathetic messaging, really confusing messaging, that's come out from several governments, not least the British government, about this. And this is largely because We have a Prime Minister here, Boris Johnson, who is a libertarian, who believes that people should be asked to do things, not told to do things, and that it should be as free as possible to do what they like. And whereas in principle that's all very well, in a pandemic situation it's pretty catastrophic, and I think this is why the British people have been confused by this messaging. The ridiculous promise that the Prime Minister made that we'd be able to have Christmas with our loved ones in December turned out to be a dreadful mistake and has led to the recent rise in cases here. So it is a complicated situation, but inevitably member states of the European Union, the 27 member states, are sovereign states. They're quite entitled to make their own arrangements if they want to get other vaccines in, as Hungary is doing from China and Russia. But the European Union, having paid for vaccines from AstraZeneca and others, would like to see those arrive as soon as possible. Though, as I mentioned earlier, I think there really is a genuine problem in actual production at the moment.
Ian Williams, here's a different perspective. We have wealthy countries arguing over the vaccine. The poorer countries are not even getting a glimpse of what they need. So what's the situation going to be like for the poor and lower income countries of the world? We know this is a global pandemic, and if it's to end, it has to end globally.
Well, I have to give some credit to the European Union there. They have made serious efforts with the COVAX program to attempt to make sure that supplies are available for other countries. But naturally, they have taxpayers. The taxpayers have put this money up, their taxpayers, and they want first dibs in it. The fact that the European Union is allowing vaccines to go to other countries, even while people at home are clamoring for them, is, you know, that's the way it should be. That's the way it should be. And we should encourage that. But there is a sense of responsibility here, and I just want to pick up where Jonathan left. In an older golden days of British responsibility and politics, any other Prime Minister would have handed in his resignation after presiding over a series of decisions that cost tens of thousands of his constituents' lives. And the fact that Johnson is still there, still unabashed, and still unresigned, I think, shows that we are dealing with a completely different degree of political responsibility now.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Mr. Williams, I'm sorry we're running short of time for this program. Allow me to thank my guest, author and broadcaster Jonathan Fryer, joining us from London. Also thanks to senior analyst at Foreign Policy In Focus, Mr. Ian Williams, speaking to us from New York. Also a special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
French President Emmanuel Macron has said Europe will not block or ban exports of coronavirus vaccines, but that they should be controlled, accusing AstraZeneca of a lack of transparency after the British-Swedish pharmaceutical company said it could not fulfill the whole of its contract with the European Union. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Kim Wilshire. The piece is titled Macron Calls for COVID Vaccine Exports from EU to be Controlled. Stay with us for more of Kim Wilshire's article. French President Emmanuel Macron has said Europe will not block or ban exports of coronavirus vaccines, but that they should be controlled, accusing AstraZeneca of a lack of transparency after the British-Swedish pharmaceutical company said it could not fulfill the whole of its contract with the European Union. The French president insisted it was in everyone's interest for all countries to have access to vaccines. He also said the AstraZeneca vaccine, given approval by the European Union regulator on Friday for use on all adults, appeared to be quasi-ineffective on people older than 65, though Macron acknowledged he had no figures or official information. Last week, AstraZeneca enraged European Union officials by announcing that only 25% of the deliveries would be possible in the first quarter of 2021, owing to production problems at the Belgian plant, and that it could not make good on the shortages by importing from the United Kingdom. Imagine the hypothesis that the British finish their vaccine campaign with success. What will they do? Stop European lorries from entering? Where there is a total dependence on the continent. Bon courage or good luck, Emmanuel Macron said. And imagine the hypothesis that France, Italy, Germany have a vaccine strategy that is extremely ambitious and rapid. It will quickly fail if our neighbours don't have the same vaccine strategy because our economies are integrated. France have 500,000 trans-border workers, so all of this will only work if we do it together. Speaking at the Élysée Palace, Emmanuel Macron said, vaccine exports should be controlled, not blocked or banned, which would make no sense because we're also dependent on non-European production. It should be controlled because there is questionable behaviour and we will be receiving fewer deliveries that do not honour the contractual engagements agreed upon. He added that Europe's response to the contractual failure will be proportional. But we cannot have contractual agreements made with laboratories then reviewed because of pressure from one or other countries. The situation with vaccines is unusual, but I believe strongly in benefits of cooperation. AstraZeneca is a major laboratory that has its base in the United Kingdom, but it also has a very strong presence in France and Europe. There is no benefit to having a strategy of non-cooperation. There has been a lack of transparency in the lack of information given, particularly from AstraZeneca. We have doubts and we want to be sure that if a company is not able to honour its contract, it's not because it has over-delivered elsewhere. And that's why cooperation is so important, Emmanuel Macron said. The European Medicines Agency authorised the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine for use in all adult age groups on Friday, 26th of January, after German authorities had earlier recommended that its use be limited to people under the age of 65 due to a lack of data about efficacy in older groups. The vaccine's developers and regulators in the United Kingdom have strongly defended its efficacy in all age groups. Going further, the German authorities, who had assessed only that efficacy had not yet been demonstrated for over 65s, Emmanuel Macron suggested the vaccine was less useful in the immediate crisis at hand. Macron said, "We have to be realistic. The real problem with the AstraZeneca vaccine is that it doesn't work in the way we expected. We have very little information, but all the indications today are that it is quasi-ineffective for those over the age of 65. Our vaccine strategy is to inoculate health workers and the elderly because it is they who have the most serious symptoms. Today, when I look at our hospitals, 80% of patients with COVID-19 are over the age of 65, and two-thirds of those in intensive care units are over 65. Emmanuel Macron continued by saying, "The AstraZeneca vaccine is no doubt superb in the long term, and it will be useful, but it's not exactly what we need today. In further critical remarks, President Macron added, AstraZeneca is not a vaccine-producing company. I have a lot of respect for the researchers who have tried to participate in the collective effort. They have done great research at Oxford, but they clearly have problems with the development, as we have seen. We hope that this can be improved. Macron said it was not his role to question other countries' vaccination policies, but he did suggest the British government was playing fast and loose with their science by extending the period between the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine doses to 12 weeks. When you read all the health notices, when even the producers say that for it to work there has to be two injections, which is the case with the Pfizer vaccine, when you listen to the scientists, I'm not sure you can say you are vaccinating when you have had the first injection of a vaccine that needs two injections, he said. Emmanuel Macron added, if, and I say if because I don't have the figures, you inoculate the over 65s with the AstraZeneca vaccine, and if, as I have heard it, it may only be around 10% effective, then your figures make no sense. What I do know, because it is established, is that if you give two injections of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine 28 days apart, then you're covered at 90% level. President Macron appeared to be referring to an article in the German business newspaper Handelsblatt, which claimed the rate was only 8% in over 65s. The Handelsblatt report has been widely challenged as incorrect, including by the German Health Ministry, which suggested it had mixed up the efficacy rate for the over 65s with a proportion of older people involved in the AstraZeneca trials of the vaccine. Emmanuel Macron added, we have to find a balance. I'm not in favor of abandoning all precautions. We have to rely on good science. If we have vaccine programs that don't respect the science, that's a problem for me. It's putting our citizens in possible danger. Meanwhile, Chris Whitty, Britain's chief medical officer, has said delaying the second dose of a vaccine was a public health decision based on the best advice and balance of risks. But the move has proved controversial. Whilst there is evidence from trials that a 12-week gap does not reduce the efficacy of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine, Pfizer has stressed it has no data on whether protection after the first dose of the vaccine is sustained after 3 weeks. Asked about the cross-channel blame game over not just vaccines but Brexit and coronavirus controls, in which Emmanuel Macron is often personally named, Macron laughed off the personal attacks. He said, whenever there is a problem with the European Union, the British just love to detest the French and me and say we are responsible. I've accepted this role sometimes when there are tensions. I ask, why me? It is perhaps making me out to be more important than I really am. On a more serious note, Emmanuel Macron added, I like your country a lot, but as I have already said, I think Brexit is an error. I respect the sovereignty of the people, and the people voted, so it had to be done. But I think that vote was based on a lot of lies, and now we see it has made things much more difficult in many ways.
Good morning.
Good morning.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.